Hey, this is DeRay, and welcome to Pod Save the People. In this episode, it's me, DR, and Kaya talking about the underreported news of the week. And then I sit down with Chris Giraldi, an investigative reporter for New York Focus, covering the state's criminal legal system. We talk about the history and future of solitary confinement in this country as we know it. Super informative, learned a lot. You've heard a lot about solitary confinement, but you will learn in this one. Here we go. My advice for this week is to stay where you stay, leave when you leave. That part of the battle is like showing up in people's lives and being present, but you know, sometimes you gotta go, and knowing when to go is really some of the work sometimes. So stay when you stay, go when you go.
Family, welcome to another episode of Pod Save the People. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
We made it. We made it. I am DR Ballinger. You can find me on Instagram at DR Ballinger.
I'm Kaya Henderson. You can find me on Twitter at Henderson Kaya.
I'm DeRay at DRAY on Twitter.
So lots going on, as usual. America is in utter chaos. I don't know if you all saw what happened with the speaker election, Kevin McCarthy, and how many millions of times it took before he got elected. A six-year-old in Newport News, Virginia, shot his teacher. Thank God she is surviving thus far. Yes, all those things are going on. But what my co-hosts want to talk about is Prince Harry. So I just, you know, want to set that up so we know what our priorities are for 2023.
Don't do that to us. Don't do that to us. We also want to talk about the speaker thing. We want to talk about it all. We got range. We can do it all. What my co-host
It's been a lot going on since the last time we talked.
It is. Also, Megan Thee Stallion, justice was served there with Tory Lanez. That happened.
Yeah. Okay. Where are we starting?
I mean, let's just get Prince Harry over with. I have to say, I'm tired of the both of them. Honey. I had a lot of grace over the holidays because I did watch a million hours of their show on Netflix. And I actually was like really starting to develop even more empathy and understanding for them. But now I'm sick of it. Now I'm
Girl,
sick and tired.
Say it. I'm the exact same thing. I watched the documentary. I was like, oh, wow. Like he's got PTSD from his mother. He wants to protect his family. The royals are trash, blah, blah, blah. And I was totally on their side after the documentary. And then, honey, all this spare stuff and you spilling all the tea. And at the same time talking about, I just want my brother and my father back. No, you don't, bruh. Like, this is too much. It's way too much. It is nuclear. It is, like, there's too much. And y'all need to go sit down somewhere. Like, whoever is, like, coordinating the timing of their public stuff is just wrong. Because they should have let the documentary marinate for a little while, build public whatever, whatever. But this, dropping this book right behind the documentary is absolutely, it's going to backfire on them tremendously.
And what do you think the backfire is too much too soon? Like, what do you think the, because I could see people advising them, like, get the whole story out in one fell swoop. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. But I mean, public pressure is going, I mean, I think public sympathy, just, me and Diara are John Q. Public, Joan Q. Public.
Why can't I get a public? I didn't watch the documentary. The only thing I saw on Twitter was when she said she never identified as Black, and people were like, okay, girl, okay.
Did she say that? Because that's not what the documentary says. That's not what the documentary says.
Kaya, all her friends were named Rachel, every single one.
Yeah, she says something like, one of the quotes is like, I didn't see myself as a Black woman. Like, that was one of the things that Twitter, that like surfaced in Twitter that people are talking about.
Yeah, that's the truth. She still calls herself mixed race. Like, what is that mixed race?
Girl,
come on, girl. Come on.
So that's when I saw people get off the train.
I felt like in the documentary, she just talked about like not being Black enough, not being white enough, not fitting. Her whole life is a question of like where she belongs, right? And, you know, that's cool, whatever. I get it. That's not my experience and whatever. But, you know, your mama's going to tell you at some point they're going to figure out that you're a Black woman and treat you as such. So whether you claim it or not, welcome to the party, Black girl. Here it is. All of this is wrought from that. Yeah. So But well,
why?
I think,
but tell me why you're over it. That's what I don't get. Like, why? What do you think was the mistake by putting it all? I'm neutral about this. I'm actually just curious.
So I think, I mean, Harry is spilling real tea, like very intimate.
Like, my brother hit me. He made me wear the Nazi outfit. Da, 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 da.
He's cheating all on his wife. All of that stuff, right? And like, if you are really trying to repair things with your family, you are not putting all of that stuff out, right? And so you look disingenuous.
You feel like the documentary was like, I can't believe they did this to me. I want to make it right. And then the book is like, F those people.
Give it to them. Okay, I mean, if the book does not do that, the publicity around the book I'm throwing it all. Now, there's a part of me that also feels like, and this is my last comment because I don't think that much about this, but there's a part of me that feels like he thinks that he is in a unique position to blow up the monarchy and force change, right? That nobody else is gonna break ranks. Nobody else is gonna like say the stuff. And I think he thinks that he's trying to push for something different, but I think they are gonna circle the wagons. I think if he thought he was a spare before, we don't even need a spare no more. And I think he and Meghan better move on because this thing is over.
Got it.
I just feel like this is also just the beginning of the end for this whole thing. Like,
I think he thinks that too.
All of us have had a grandma who couldn't die because we had uncles and cousins who just depended on her and she kept it together. And now, you know, when grandma passed, you know, when granny passes, that's it. Everything falls
It's all
to pieces.
A mess, literally. That's everything. It. No more family dinners. Aunts not talking to each other no more. The cousins don't get along. Yes.
Yo.
Yes.
And I used to watch the British Parliament for all of this chicanery and shenanigans. And now it's right at our doorstep in our Congress where we got the same rock'em sock'em action that the Brits do.
You know, the confidence of mediocre white men is really something to be studied. Because Kevin was like, it's cool. The quote, he said, it's not where you start, it's where you finish.
Yes, that is, I mean... 15 votes later.
What? My ego, like, if people voted against me 15 times, you would see it on my face.
We would never get to 15 because two or three, I'd be like, you know what? Let's try something different.
And the black guy, whatever that black guy is, who I didn't even know existed, by the way.
Oh my God.
Nobody knew.
Where he got those fake 20 votes and up there talking about they believe. You're like, sir, these people, what delusion are you? They are playing you so hard. They pat you on the head. And you're talking about.
They're not even playing you. Like, I mean, it is just, and you're like, yeah, use me. It's okay. Bend me over. Sure.
But you know, but it's also just like, and it took me to the Herschel Walker thing, because whoever is behind the election of these people and you can see now what they are trying to do. Like, they are trying to create chaos so that our government can be in chaos, so that they can get away with whatever shenanigans they're trying to get away with. Because now we understand why these folks are in Congress. Like, it is that.
And George Santos, they put him up. Like, these people are just bankrolling these absolute clowns.
We don't even know if his name is George Santos, a.k.a. Billy Bean, a.k.a.
Right.
We don't even know.
Oh, my soul. What is this place? Where do I get off the ride? Tell me.
And some people didn't like it, but I really did like Hakeem Jeffries' little ABCD.
Oh my God, I loved it.
He delivered it well. You didn't know. We never heard him talk. There wasn't like any of us could pinpoint a single thing that man had ever said out loud. I mean, I've met him and know him, blah, blah, but what speech he's ever given. And when he started, I'm like, I don't know where this is going. And then I'm like, you better come on with the ABCD preacher, call and response, got the new mod. They're like, you got the whole thing.
He had me going. In with maturity, out with Mar-a-Lago. I said, you go ahead.
And he delivered it like
to the people.
He delivered
like
it
a
like,
Baptist preacher.
Yeah,
like, also like Brooklyn. Like he's
yes.
from Brooklyn.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah.
But it wasn't like reading. You know, we all have given talks. And to do that well from A to Z is actually pretty difficult. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like that's not like a,
but
that is not an easy skill.
He had this long, long ass vote to memorize that whole thing. That's
he
probably
did.
What
he did it. I was like, go ahead, boo. And you know, some of the haters were like, da-da-da. But I'm like, I thought it was great. I thought it was a great way to use the moment. I was pretty pumped.
I'm excited. I'm so excited for him. And I'm so excited, like, just to have like another spokesperson for like our party and what we're doing because we need one. Let me just say that.
I mean, you are my resident what's going on with the Dems person. And so, like, will we be able to meet the moment? Will we be able to seize the opportunity? I mean, it was a good showing during the speaker debacle, right? I think the Dems stage united, people were on message. It was lovely. And it gave me a moment of hope that, like, maybe we could get out of our own way and make something happen. Yep. What's your prognostication for 2023, Diarra?
Well, you know, it's fascinating because I was in D.C. this weekend and ended up with some old, you know, my friends who are kind of still in that world. And one of them was like, you know, Joe Biden has accomplished so much. And I was like, tell me more. And she started to go through all these accomplishments. And I was like, you know, that is not being communicated widely. Like, because if we don't know that, like, who? So I think I'm hoping that with Hakeem Jeffries comes sort of a new layer or a new excitement around where we even go to look for what's happening, right? Because it's like, okay, well, now I know I can go to Hakeem, I can go to his socials to figure out what's going on. Because, you know, I don't know if we're, you know, looking to Joe Biden's Twitter to figure out the latest and greatest around what's happening. And like, are we supposed to go to whitehouse.gov? Like, where are we supposed to go to see said accomplishments? So I don't know. I just thought that was interesting. So my news today is out of Kenya. And this news spoke to me because I spent a lot of time out of the country over the holidays. And one of the places I went was Morocco. And so although this news is about Kenya, I think what has been sitting with me is, even though I love Marrakesh and I love Morocco, that, you know, Pal and I as a couple aren't necessarily completely comfortable there. And so I think just the having to walk around, not being able to hold hands, having to walk around, being very discreet, having to, like, things that I think we take so much for granted in some places in the United States was very much like charged in Marrakesh. And so when I was looking for news, I actually came across this gay rights activist that was killed recently in Kenya. I feel like Miles talks about this often, just in that, you know, there's still so much hatred and homophobia, transphobia, et cetera, in the world. And like, I think oftentimes in New York City and DC and some of our bubbles, it's just not top of mind, but there are still places where it is, and still places in the United States where it is literally illegal to love who you love and to be who you want, who you are in your body. And so Edwin Chiloba, his body was dumped on a roadside in Kenya. Police have arrested a friend and they're pursuing two others in the case. He is a prominent figure. He's a fashion designer, a model, etc. And this has just raised so many questions in Kenya. I think that's what journalists are telling us, that it has raised lots of questions about dangers and discrimination that face gay people in East Africa. But yeah, I just was so impacted by this and the photos, because then of course I went into a spiral looking at his photos, and they're so beautiful, and you kind of forget that what he's doing is also has so much danger in it. So there's a very prominent and courageous LGBT community in Kenya. So they're asking for swift investigation when it comes to figuring out what's going on. The Kenyan Human Rights Commission has called this, you know, called the killing reprehensible and deeply unjust. And there's also a worry around violence escalating for gay Kenyans. But this was one where I just, you know, I think not that I forget, but that it is, I wonder, for so many queer folks, what news like this, what kind of daily living without this unprocessed trauma, like what that does to us over the long term. So I just wanted to bring it to the pod because I was just feeling some kind of way given my travels. And then I saw this and I was like, this is wild.
Yeah, thank you for bringing it, Diarra. I think because we live in a place where where LGBTQ folks can at least have a more significant modicum of safety and freedom. One, it reminds me that everybody ain't free here either. We don't have to go all the way to Kenya to see homophobia or transphobia or violence against the LGBTQ community. But it also reminds me that in most places in the world, people can't live how they want to live and love who they want to love. And I am, you know, I think for me, it raises the question of like, what does allyship look like in moments like this? What are we as individuals able to do to help shift perspectives in other places? It's a real question for me. How can I be supportive as an ally in moments like this is the question that this raises for me. And I don't have easy answers, but I think being conscious of what is happening is the first step. So if people have suggestions about what we could be doing to be supportive, I'm all ears. Hit us up on Twitter or Instagram or whatever and let us know what you think.
I will say it was heartbreaking. And, you know, this is one of the hard things about the internet is I inadvertently saw the video of his body being taken out of the box because it was all over Twitter. And it just is like, you're just reminded that it just is dangerous to be gay, to be queer in so many places, and that people, people are really brave and courageous and show up as who they are. And it leads to dire consequences. I think about when I was in Ghana, I tweeted that I was there and a set of gay activists, like they wanted to meet. I met with them, but it was like, I didn't post any photos. I didn't, you know, it was like, they were like, there are moments where we can be safe, but it was like, I just have too many files. I don't want to inadvertently contribute to any harm. And they were just like, yeah, but it's still not safe in so many places. And you think about like Grindr, Jacked, all those apps, and, you know, people use them to prey on queer people, to lure them into situations and harm them or kill them. And it just is like, you know, such a vicious reminder. And this young man was so young and full of life and out and, you know, like all the things. And it's so, so tragic and so sad. And a reminder that we got a lot of work to do. Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People's coming.
My news today is about some of the unintended consequences of the overturning of the Roe v. Wade decision. This news is about a young couple in Louisiana, Caitlin Joshua and her husband Landon, who are parents of a four-year-old and who found themselves pregnant with a second child and were very, very excited about it. And in Louisiana, there is actually a near total abortion ban that came into effect after the overturning became effective August 1st, where basically you cannot have an abortion for any reason, including rape and incest. There's a narrow exception on the ban for miscarriages, but the language is super vague. There's fear and confusion, and all of this is leading to delays in pregnancy care. First of all, Louisiana as a state has one of the highest maternal death rates in the country. You know, if that's the case for white folks, it's particularly white women, is particularly detrimental, higher risk for Black women. There is a very high bar for physicians to prove that they have not been involved in any kind of abortion, because what the law says is if you provide an abortion or abortion services, you get 10 to 15 years in jail, $100,000 to $200,000 in fines, and you lose your medical license. So this law has had a chilling effect across the medical community, and it shows up in situations like the Joshuas, who went from excited to have a second child to having a complete and total medical crisis because First, they couldn't make an 8-week prenatal appointment because no clinic sees women until after 12 weeks anymore. The reason is because many women miscarry in the first 12 weeks. And so if you're miscarrying, the medical term for miscarriage is actually spontaneous abortion. And so you, if somebody is miscarrying, you have to put that down on their hospital records. And the according to the medical community, the word abortion triggers an investigation by the state. And in part because many of the same treatments that are all of the same treatments that are used for abortion are used for miscarriage. So doctors are fearful to meet to treat miscarriages. So you can't get a prenatal appointment until you're 12 weeks. This lady wanted to make one at 8 weeks, like she did for her first baby, but she could not. And it turns out at week 10, between weeks 10 and 11, she starts bleeding heavily, passing clots and tissues. She had worse pain than when she was giving birth. And after visits to two different medical facilities, a clinic and an ER, nobody would confirm that she was having a miscarriage. All the signs were there. But nobody would say miscarriage. They wouldn't refer her for any treatment options. They wouldn't even state miscarriage on her medical records because they were worried about triggering an investigation. And when you ask the policy people, first of all, somebody is going to have to tell me about this woman who I think must be a sister, Senator Katrina Jackson, because I don't know a whole lot of white women named Katrina Jackson, but who knows? Sister Katrina, I think, is a, Sister Katrina is a Democrat. The sister is the part in question. Look it up for me, DR. Let me know. But Katrina Jackson in
confirm Katrina. Confirmed. Katrina is a sister. Confirm.
Right. Sister Katrina, Katrina
R. Jackson,
who is a Democrat, is the author of the ban. And I'm going to give her a little grace and assume that she tried to write so that the far, far right folks didn't go too far. But she says the law is actually clear about miscarriages. And the woman who represents the Louisiana Right to Life Coalition says the fault is not with the law, but with the misinterpretation of the law. Policymakers, stop this these shenanigans. We wrote the right law, but people are just misinterpreting it. If the impact and effect of the law is that people cannot get the health care that they need, then you need to write a better policy, or you need to put policy guidelines out or clarification or whatever. These are women's lives that we're talking about. And you want to tell me that people just don't know how to interpret the law? This is some BS. This law is having the absolute intended effect that it was supposed to have, which is to a chilling effect, to actually delay and prevent medical care for women. And we all know that miscarriages are deadly in many cases if left untreated. And Miss Caitlin Joshua and her husband Landon, I mean, Caitlin says she felt totally abandoned. She felt like she was being written off by the doctors and the medical staff. There's the, you're having a miscarriage issue. Let's layer on top of that, you're a Black woman and medical professionals don't always listen to Black women. She says she wondered, like, do white women get treated this way? All to say she was left at home by herself, bleeding. Two ERs, totally. I mean, this is out of control. Ultimately passing the baby at home, without supervised medical care. And, you know, the long-term effect, she and her husband have decided, you know what, one kid is enough, because it's dangerous to get pregnant in a place like Louisiana. Could you imagine young couples feeling like they cannot get pregnant because they can't get the medical care that they need? And so for all of these right to lifers who, you know, whatever, I want to talk about what happens when this happens, what happens when people are miscarrying and can't get the medical attention that they need. This is one of the unintended consequences, or maybe intended consequences, of the overturning of Roe v. Wade. And it absolutely breaks my heart. And I just wanted to bring it to the pod because I think, you know, people just think that folks are out here trying to get an abortion because they messed up or whatever, whatever. And the women's health issues around reproductive health and reproductive services are so much more complex. And I thought that this was a real illumination of that point.
You know, I'm always shocked, I guess. And maybe I shouldn't be shocked, but at how policy like impacts people's real lives in ways that men just don't think about. And men are pushing these things through. And it's like, you can tell that it came, you know, it clearly came from a, like, you know, we want more babies to be born who are white. Like, that feels like that is true and real. And the downstream consequences of it are just so wild. Like, that is already wild enough. Like, women should be able to control their own body. But just the almost routine, like, routine health issues are suddenly now huge obstacles for women. And the only thing I could think about was how this is definitely by class, right? Rich women are fine. They're going to go somewhere else, pay some doctor to come to the house, travel across that. Like, they will not be impacted in the same way that middle class and poor women will be. And that's all I think about with this, is that when these rich politicians get the side chick pregnant, they will be fine, right? And it's like, you just think about how dangerous these are for just the health. You know, healthcare is already hard, right? It's hard when you got all the bells and whistles. And still, this becomes a challenge. So, yeah, thanks for bringing it.
And I think the other thing is that, like, there's more to come, right? Like, now legislatures are going back into session. Texas is a place where they're still going to be pushing, like, making sure employers can't provide abortions for their employees. So I think, you know, I think this is, it really is, and going back to Democratic leadership, you know, for a long time, we weren't paying attention to the judiciary. And I think Biden is doing a great job in making sure that we're getting more Democrats on the bench. But this is going to be a continued onslaught if we don't continue to get more Democrats on the bench. Like, it's just, this is something that Republicans have been working on and working on and working on for decades. And they have so much now systemic and institutional advantage. And so we really have to keep our eye on it. And we really have to get active around how we really prioritize who gets put on benches. And it's not just this issue, right? It's all kinds of issues that deeply impact folks of color. So all that to say, I think we, you know, really, you know, kind of following Planned Parenthood closely, NARAL, like these organizations that are really trying hard to push against this, both from a policy level, but also a legal and legislative level.
So my news, I feel like I say this all the time, where I'm like, you know, I'm really shocked. And then something comes up and I'm like, whoa, the system is just crazier than I. You're just like, what is the what? This is a whole episode about sort of women's bodies and health and bodies in general and queer people. So this it was reported in azcentral.com. Arizona is inducing the labor of pregnant women incarcerated against their will. And what? I read it and I was like, what? And Arizona, there are three women who have allowed their health records to be made public. And they were induced not of their own will. The Arizona Department of Corrections didn't respond to requests from the media. And then the state prison's healthcare contractor, NAFCARE, denied having a policy of forced inductions. And they just started their service with Arizona on October 1st of 2022. Centurion, the last prison healthcare contractor, didn't respond at all to requests about it. But when pressed, there's like no policy decision for why you would induce the labor of women against their will. It doesn't make sense. It's like, it's so weird, and it's obviously a violation of the law. Arizona passed a Dignity for Incarcerated Women Act in 2021, and the law ensured that there were adequate amounts of feminine hygiene products. The law also prohibited shackling of prisoners during labor, required appropriate prenatal care, and mandates that the mother be able to spend 72 hours with the baby after the birth. You can pass all these laws, but the implementation actually really, really matters. And thankful that the women stepped up and made their stories public, and saddened that they had stories to even make public. But I brought this here because I was just like, I don't even know from a policy perspective, like, what would make you, like, why would you do this? This is just like, they're going to have the babies. You know when the due dates are. Just very odd.
You know, Dore, this is like inductions are now almost unsaid national policy. So inductions have increased like 30-something% since they first started in the late 1980s, as well as C-sections. And when you talk about women of color, it's almost always that they push for C-sections, even if you don't have any kind of, or, you know, risk around it. So it all comes down to like making things cheaper and more efficient and easier for healthcare providers. And so, you know, this whole C-section thing is pushed because surgeons like to operate on women. And so that's the point of, you know, why C-sections has increased. But a really good resource is actually is the documentary Aftershock, because it really breaks down the increase in it breaks down what's happening with the medical system and how that impacts Black women, women of color in terms of birthing. But this is one that doesn't surprise me at all, because they want everybody to get induced now, because it makes it so that there's less time in the hospital, right? So the hospital is not carrying a burden of having just for you to wait and have your natural, you know, birth. So it's wild. What's even wilder, I feel like, is it doesn't, you know, birthing, pregnancy, all of it, women's health, it's getting to be where it doesn't matter what your socioeconomic status is. Like, it doesn't matter how privileged you are. We're all treated the same. So I think it's one of those things where I think it can really be like a point of unification among women, because it's getting to the point, obviously it's worse for women of color, but it's getting to the point, like, it doesn't matter who you are. Like, your chances of getting good treatment in this country are slim.
Boom.
Besides the policy stuff, like, just how this impacts the women individually, right? Like, they weren't explained to why this was happening, right? And actually, like, there was one reason that I thought was pretty, like, decent, which is, you know, if a prisoner goes into labor in her cell by herself or whatever, right, and they don't get to her in time, like, it's high risk and whatnot. So if you're inducing, it's in a controlled environment and whatnot. There was a mentally ill woman who gave birth in her cell, and that didn't work out. And so, like, one, talk to me as an individual and explain to me why you're doing this. And one woman said something like, you know, but like, they can do anything to us because we're state property, right? Like, can you imagine feeling like you have literally no control over even this, like, probably what is the most intimate, the most, I don't know, whatever experience. And, you know, another lady says something like, you know, just because I made some bad choices doesn't mean that, you know, you get to control my body. But in fact, that's the whole premise of the prison industrial complex. Like, you think about what mothers and children need in that moment, right? You think about a body being ready for labor or not ready for labor and being pushed to labor. In fact, these ladies, you know, the one of the women says it's a much more active labor. It took 2 days or it took 3 days for me to have this baby with the induction as opposed to a spontaneous birth. I mean, all of these things they call them human rights violations, crimes against the body. And I just can't imagine it. And I don't know, you know, Dore, to your point, these are men making these decisions for the most part. And even when it happens to your girlfriend, your wife, your sister, your whatever, like, the distance between really what is happening and the laws and the policy that you make is so great that, like, until we, for me, this is the case for, like, why we need women to be leaders, women policymakers, because the people closest to the problem often have the best solutions. And there's no way that a man can legislate what needs to happen with my body. Like, I sound so 1975, but like, it's just the truth. And there's example after example after example of why this can't keep working.
Oh, see, there's a really good series on Instagram, like Instagram Reels. I posted it. Maybe you've seen it, where it's like a woman goes up and asks men like questions about women's bodies. She's like, you know, what is a period? And then the men answer it. Or she's like, hi, do you have to take out the tampon when you pee? Like, she asks all these questions, and to see men struggle, like just struggle through the answers is so fascinating. 'Cause you're like, you know, basics, people are like, they just don't have it, right? And it is, she's so good at it, and she's so unassuming. It's just such a good reminder, because I'm like, none of these people in any elected office could be, they couldn't explain any of this stuff. What's a fetus? Like, they don't know. And her series sticks out to me. Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Don't go anywhere. There's more to come. This week, we welcome investigative reporter Chris Giraldi on the pod to talk about his report titled Lesser Infractions Aren't Supposed to Land You in Solitary Confinement. They do anyway. Chris gave us the 411 on a new reform law known as the Humane Alternatives to Long-Term Solitary Confinement, also known as HALT Act. The law led to a steep decline in the official solitary confinement population, but his investigation found that DOCCS has failed to implement major facets of the law. We talked through his findings and the future of solitary confinement, which hopefully shouldn't have a future. Here we go.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for joining us today on Pod Save the People.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I'm really glad to be here.
Now, let's start with how did you get to writing about prisons and jails? Like, what's your story? Did you know you always cared about these issues? Like, what got you interested in these issues?
So since I've been a journalist, I have focused on what I kind of call like the state violence beat. I was a freelancer for a long time, so I could pretty much cover what I wanted. And, you know, I'm of a political persuasion that thinks that, you know, the state has the most capacity to do good, but it's also has the most capacity to do violence. And so I started off covering like immigration enforcement. This was right when Trump was elected. And, you know, ICE was kind of on a rampage. So I started with that and covered some things on the U.S. military, the U.S. military's role in the war in Yemen, and moved to some issues on U.S. colonialism. But, you know, behind all that, like the main feature, I guess, that we can see of state violence in the U.S. is the carceral system. And that's always kind of been in the background. And so I've always kind of been interested in it, been covering it a lot. And then, you know, 2020 happened and it was in vogue, which is good. It's people paying attention, and there was a lot more editor interest, you know, a lot more public interest in that kind of stuff. So I've been, involved in it ever since. I also have a little bit of a personal connection to it. And not in a way that I think a lot of people do. My father is actually a corrections officer in a county jail for 20 years in Michigan.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I kind of grew up, he was a SEAL for 20 years. And, you know, there's a lot of like weird stuff about that, but I really saw how it burnt him out and how he came home with like some brutal stories. And so I kind of had it growing up on that end a little bit. So it's always kind of like been in the background of my personal life, but I think politically it's one of the issues that I think, yeah, everyone should be into.
Now let's talk about the article that you recently wrote about solitary confinement in New York prisons. Can you just start at the basics though? So like, what is HALT? Why does it matter? And what does it mean for the state? Does it apply to the city too? Is it just the city? Is it the state? Like, give us the 101.
Sure, yeah. So this is a state law. It was passed Governor Andrew Cuomo signed it on March 31st of 2021. They gave prisons and jails a year to implement it. So it only went into effect on March 31st of this year. And it covers all state prisons, all county jails, yeah, all jails and prisons, all carceral settings in New York State. So it does cover New York City, it covers Rikers, it covers all of that. And it's called, it's the humane alternative to long-term solitary confinement. That's where HALT comes from. And it's pretty much, it's a very robust reform law is what I would call it. It doesn't, you know, it's not like dismantling prisons, not really dismantling the institution of solitary confinement, but it puts a lot into place. One of the main features is it sets a time limit on how long prisons and jails are allowed to keep people in solitary confinement. So it's 15 consecutive days. And that kind of comes from some United Nations publications. You know, the United Nations has called solitary confinement torture, and especially torture if it's longer than 15 days. So that's kind of where that number came from. It also places limits on whom prisons and jails can send to solitary confinement. So nobody with any sort of disability, no pregnant people, nobody over 65. And it also places limits on the reasons that jails and prisons can send people to solitary. So it's purely punitive. Like prisons and jails can only send people to solitary for a specific set of mostly like violent infractions to jail rules. And then it also, for people who, you know, prison and jail authorities think should be kept away from the general population for longer than 15 days, it creates a entire new kind of carceral unit called residential rehabilitation units, which are supposed to be these kind of like therapeutic units where people in them are supposed to get a certain amount of like out of cell time, a certain amount of recreation time, and therapeutic programming. So they're supposed to have like classroom style group setting programming to, you know, help them through whatever they're going through. So it's a really robust law. There's more to it, but those are the main facets of it.
Now, what did your study find? Is the state complying with it? Is it almost complying with it? Is there something that makes it unable to be complied with?
So it is not at all complying with it. We still have to dig into jails. Jails are a whole other story. Jails are in across the country, not just in New York. They're extremely hard to regulate because they're on the county level, and they're sporadic. So that's TBD whether or what's happening in the jails with solitary confinement. But on the state level, in New York's many prisons, the prison system is pretty much flouting almost the entirety of the law. So they're holding, I mentioned the 15-day limit, they're currently holding more people for longer than 15 days than they are people like under 15 days. They're like violating that.
Whoa. One
yeah, it's kind of crazy. They're sending people with with severe mental health needs to solitary confinement, which is very much against the law. They're sending people to solitary confinement for reasons, for like minor-ish infractions. And they're treating, so I mentioned the kind of like alternate therapeutic units. I've talked to a lot of incarcerated people that are just saying like they pretty much treat them just like solitary confinement. They're not getting their out of cell time. These like supposedly like this supposedly therapeutic classroom time is really just like them sitting at a desk with really nothing, maybe a worksheet or something. Or an instructor that hasn't really been given any instructions and is just kind of winging it. Also in these alternate units, the prisons are shackling them to desks, which is explicitly against HALT. So the therapeutic classroom time is supposed to be for like 2 or 3 hours, and they're shackled to the desk that entire time. So they say it's pretty brutal, and it's almost almost as bad as being in solitary itself. And so they're flagrantly violating it. And the prison system itself has actually we've found implemented public facing directives that say that it is adhering to the law, but privately issuing orders and memos and things like that that violate the law and just kind of like saying that they are in accordance with the law. So with the disabilities thing, sending people with disabilities to solitary confinement there, they have this like creative interpretation of what a disability is. So they, you know, it's all sort of like prison jargon, and they have their own sort of classification systems, and they've designated certain health classifications as like eligible for solitary confinement, even though the law clearly forbids that. And same thing with the shackling. Like they said that they're not supposed to be shackling people to desks and that guards aren't supposed to be doing that. But the prison commissioner privately sent a memo to superintendents that said that you should be shackling people to desks whenever they're out of their cells. So it's really wild. It's really flagrant. And they just really haven't been called out for it.
So before I ask you, like, what are people supposed to do or what are the consequences, I would love to hear you talk about, you know, a lot of people, when they hear solitary confinement, they're like, well, of course, right? Like, fights break out and you need somewhere to put people. And that's what the prison people say. The people that run the prisons are like, there's no way we can keep everybody safe without solitary confinement. What do you say to those arguments?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And this is something, yeah, especially like the prison union has said. So solitary confinement and like separating someone from the general population are, you can't really, a lot of people try to conflate those things, and they're very different. So that's kind of why HALT created these supposedly therapeutic units. It recognized that like, prisons are violent places, and there's a lot of stuff to talk about behind that. And sometimes you need to like separate people and kind of like move people around. But solitary confinement is brutal. It's psychologically torturous. Imagine just being in a cell with no one to talk to and no real stimulation. People forget that like people in prison, sometimes there's like movies and books, but like don't have internet access, don't have any sort of like stimulation like that. So you're really just like sitting in a cell for, before HALT, it was 23 hours a day. Can you imagine being in like what is essentially like a large closet for 23 Wild. Hours a day? Yeah. Supposedly now it's less than that, but we've been talking to some people and there's still a lot of prisons are still sticking to the 23 hours thing. But yeah, it's psychologically torturous, and people have been trying to address this for a long time. This law has been in the works for about a decade. Like the advocacy campaign that started it, started about a decade ago, and it took that long to, one, get people to understand just how brutal isolation is and how brutal isolation is as a punishment and how inhumane that is. And then also, yeah, to get the people in power to recognize that it's something that needed to be addressed.
So what are the consequences, right? So they're clearly violating the law. Can people sue? Do people like, do we call legislators? I don't know. What's the thing?
This is the thing. So the law also put in a lot of kind of mechanisms for oversight. It gave oversight responsibilities to a few different state bodies. But that's oversight. That's not accountability. You know, like whatever commission or whatever oversight agency or whatever state level agency can issue all the reports it wants. But still, the prison system, especially in New York State, but I imagine in most states, is borderline rogue. Like they can kind of do what they want. One, because they were founded that way, and two, because very few people pay attention. So yeah, there's reports forthcoming. I've been talking to some of these agencies that there's reports forthcoming. I've also been talking to some legislators who say that there will be hearings, but that won't be till next year because the legislature is currently out of session, and that won't start until 2023. Some of these reports also won't come out until 2023. So yeah, I think it's going to take a lot of noise. I have yet to see any, you know, people can file class action lawsuits and use the courts to try to force the prison system to comply, but that also takes time. Meanwhile, people are sitting in these horrid conditions. So there are ways for accountability, but they take a long time, and it seems like there's a real lack of urgency. I'm surprised that I've been the only one kind of reporting on this, because it's based on a lot of public information. So we'll see, but it's been real slow moving in terms of accountability so far.
You've also written about the New York prison chief, Anthony Annucci. What's his story? Is he like a, I don't know, does he just not care? Is he like an old school corrections guy? You know, why do you think he's telling people to shackle people to desks and stuff that's like clearly a violation of the law?
I think old school corrections guy is an accurate way to describe him, and an accurate way to describe a lot of people that, most people that run prison systems. He's been with the Department of Corrections and Community Supervision, formerly the Department of Corrections, for, I don't know, I don't have it in front of me, but a very long time. And he's been the acting director. He hasn't even been confirmed by the state legislature for almost a decade now, which just talks to...
What?
He's not even confirmed. He's like the acting director, and he was renominated by Governor Kathy Hochul, who, when we're recording this, just recently won her election. The state legislature recognizes that he is not doing very much, one, to implement laws and implement reform laws that they pass, but also to address prison violence, to address the dearth of mental health programs. So they didn't confirm him, but he still is able to be acting commissioner. Runs the place as he will.
Whoa, I didn't know he was acting commissioner for that long. That is wild. Do we know if there are particular prisons where the violation of the HALT Act is worse than others, or is it like across the board sort of bad, or do we have any of that data?
That is interesting. So we're trying to get that like anecdotally. One interesting thing about that is that, a couple of the people that I have been speaking with are in what are formerly known as like supermax prisons, which were just large scale solitary confinement holding units. Like they were found, like they were built to just hold as many, like everybody in solitary confinement. And one of those actually closed as a result of this law. But another one where I've been talking to people, Upstate Correctional Facility, is now kind of, it transferred from a large scale, like solitary confinement holding place to now just like this large scale residential rehabilitation unit, which is the kind of like alternate unit I was talking about that was created by this law. And from talking to people on the inside there and talking to people, a couple of people who have visited, it seems that there were some changes that took place, but it is functionally operating in the same way. So it's really crazy. Like, yeah, this was like created as like this mass solitary confinement place, and some changes, but not a lot.
What do you think's next? Like, what should we be paying attention to as this unfolds? Your reporting has helped us see that they are clearly violating the law. You said that there'll be some hearings coming up and the oversight bodies might sort of oversee, but you know, they're not changing anything. What should we be looking for? Should we be looking for the next hearing with the acting commissioner? Is there like another filing deadline that we need to pay attention to? Well, obviously pay attention to your reporting, but is there something else?
I would say, the data comes out monthly, and we'll be following up and letting everybody know, like, whether this gets better, worse, or stays the same. I kind of have my predictions. But I would look out for whatever hearings happen. I'd also look out for whenever these like large legal organizations may be able to take this to court and file these class action lawsuits. It's really kind of sad. There's, the state government has so many avenues to hold rogue agencies accountable, but it so often takes these private or like nonprofit organizations filing a lawsuit and taking it to court to actually like force them to implement these reform laws. we'll see if a big one comes out. I'll be looking for that. But I'll also be looking for, like, does this enter the conversation? In New York, I don't know how many of the listeners are in New York, but this is the thing all over the country. Bail and bail reform and crime are all sort of like tough on crime conservatives, and even conservative Democrats kind of talk about. We hear all sorts of like kind of conflations of criminal justice reform moves and these like COVID era increases in interpersonal violence, but never what like rolling back those reforms actually results in, which is more people incarcerated. And we really never hear about like the carceral conditions that those people will be sent to. So I'm really curious. It's so brazen and so wild, the stuff that the prison system is doing. I'm eager to see whether it enters the public conversation in any way that even remotely comes close to how much we're talking about like bail reform.
Okay, so the two questions we ask everybody. The first question is, what's a piece of advice that you've gotten over the years that's always stuck with you?
I would say, so one of my, when I was having sort of my political awakening, like late in college, my college mentor, I was talking about kind of despair and kind of the state of the world and what to do. And he said, let it drive you. Let whatever you're feeling be the thing that drives you to action, and drives you to do the work that you think you need to do to contribute to bettering, whatever you care about. So I think, that's it.
Boom. And the second question is, there are a lot of people who have read all of your pieces, listened to the podcast, they've voted, they've canvassed, they've protested, right? And they feel like the world has not changed the way they wanted it to. What do you say to those people?
Actually, probably the same thing. Let whatever you're feeling drive you. And also to recognize that society and politics are volatile, and whatever you're doing, whatever work you're doing may not seem like it's doing very much right now, but it will seem like a hell of a lot whenever that kind of like big spark comes. We saw this in 2020, like the people who had been doing the work on the ground for so long, when that revolutionary spark kind of came, were the ones that were leading the protests and making things happen and making the most of that big moment. So I say, if you're kind of like feeling despair and seeing really nothing happen around you, know that those kind of like sparks happen when we least suspect them. And it's important to do the groundwork up until then.
Boom. Well, we consider you a friend of the pod. Can't wait to have you back. Can you tell us, do you have a website, or like, how do we make sure we're plugged in the best to you? Or is it Twitter, or is it Instagram? What's the best way to stay in touch?
Yeah, I would say if you're in New York State, anywhere in New York State, follow our coverage. We're at nysfocus.com, and nysfocus is our Twitter. And my Twitter is just at Chris Gilardi. And I would say if you're not in New York State, try to find the local journalists and activists and anybody who is trying to get this type of information out. And whatever you need to do to like keep plugged into that, do it.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning into Pod Save the People this week. Tell your friends to check it out. Make sure to rate it wherever you get your podcast, whether it's Apple Podcasts or somewhere else. And we will see you next week. Pod Save the People is a production of Crooked Media. It's produced by AJ Moultrie and mixed by Charlotte Lands. Executive produced by me, and special thanks to our weekly contributors, Kai Henderson, D.R. Ballinger, and Miles Johnson.